Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. This episode features Tom Stevenson, Investment Director at Fidelity International, joining us from London. With the recent outperformance of value over growth, Tom will share his insights on how the story will pan out, and also shed light on the status of UK's economy relative to the EU. As for the recent market volatility, Tom will explain why and how rising bond yields come into play. Tom also shares with host Pamela Ritchie how emerging markets are a much more important part of the global economy and stock markets than they once were. Traditionally, they have been very different than developed markets, but now the correlation between EM and developed markets has increased. Today's podcast was recorded on March 12, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
To take us through what is happening now and also what's ahead perhaps on the horizon, we are joined by Investment Director Tom Stevenson from London. In addition to providing insights for Fidelity, Tom is a prolific writer and broadcaster. You can follow him on The Telegraph, Fidelity's podcast, and several other platforms. Great to see you again, Tom. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Pamela.
Very glad to have you join us here today. Tom, let's begin with sort of getting your take and parsing through what we saw from Christine Lagarde, the ECB, yesterday putting forth its decision. It sounded a little bit confusing because it was a little more of the same, but what really should we be taking that kind of keeping the ECB up at night out of the comments made yesterday?
Yeah, well, I think like everyone else, the ECB is becoming increasingly concerned about the direction of travel of bond yields. They're worried about the impact that that's going to have on funding costs for businesses and individuals within the Eurozone, which, you know, let's not forget is well behind economies like the US and indeed the UK in terms of the recovery, the vaccination program. They really could do without this rise in bond yields. So what happened yesterday was the ECB said that, okay, we're going to leave the size of our bond buying program unchanged. It's about 1.9 trillion euros, but we're going to accelerate the rate at which we implement the bond buying over the next 3 months in particular. So it is a recognition that something needs to be done to keep those bond yields in check.
We're seeing a slide in the euro. We've seen a stronger dollar. There are all of these things sort of on the playing field right now. I want to just sort of point people joining us today to an article that you wrote in the last few days for The Telegraph. And it speaks to an investor just starting out in the world of making their own money, getting a job, looking to the stock market, and really the fundamental challenges facing them right now and why that matters to the stock market. I wonder if you can kind of take us through what a younger you, younger me, all of us, if we were beginning right now, what are the problems in our mind and in reality?
Yeah, so this piece was sort of triggered in my mind by some conversations that I had with younger people, particularly my kids' generation. My children are in their 20s now. Conversations that I've had with them about GameStop, about Bitcoin, about these kinds of more speculative investments. And I was sort of puzzled about why they were thinking about these, you know, what seemed to be get rich quick schemes, really. When I thought about it, I sort of began to understand, if you look at the world that they face, you know, they've just come out of university. The property market is running away from them. They've had a year taken away from them with the pandemic. They're struggling to get on the jobs market. You know, I think I'd feel pretty cross about that situation, and I'd be looking at shortcuts if you like. And I guess the concern that I face is that for a generation, for that younger generation, they may well have a bad experience if these more speculative investments don't go well for them, and it will put them off the longer term serious investing, which they're going to increasingly have to do in a world of defined contribution pensions, where they're not going to get a final salary pension at the end of their working life. They are going to have to look after their own financial futures. And it worries me if they get a bad experience, if it puts them off that serious investing. That's what prompted the article.
And in the article, you go back and you look at, you know, if you buy and hold, which the enormous sort of the much better position you would be in. You also point out that often people don't buy and hold for a long, long time. But there is a shortening of the attention span and probably patience, right? I mean, that's sort of one of the things you're pointing to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the world which my children are growing up in, young people today just coming into the working world, remember that they've grown up in an environment of social media and sort of short-term, immediate gratification. It's almost sort of counter to what the stock market offers. The stock market, I described it in my piece, as it's a get-rich-slow machine, and it's a fantastic get-rich-slow machine. You know, over the long haul, investors are given a small premium. It's only a small premium, but you compound that up year after year after year, and you get some pretty spectacular results. But you do need to be able to stick with it for the long run. And, you know, it worries me that the world in which they've been brought up does not encourage them to have that long-term view.
When we look at what we're in right now, which appears to be the recovery, and actually we'll touch on some numbers that have come out of the UK recently and so on, but, you know, it appears to be we're entering this recovery. There's been some stumbles along the way. There are now concerns about a taper tantrum. Probably we're seeing a taper tantrum. Is it the same as last time around? I'm thinking of the great financial crisis. You know, at this point, optimism's coming back on, and we're stumbling. We're worried about sort of the tapering aspect of it. Why is it the same, and maybe why is it different?
Yes, I mean, I wrote about this recently, and I said it's not. It's there's a reminder of the taper tantrum of 2013, when, you know, you'll remember Ben Bernanke at the time just hinted that the quantitative easing bond buying program, which had been put in place after the financial crisis in 2008, what he was saying was at some point we're going to have to rein this back. That was the taper, and the tantrum, of course, was the market reaction. Now we're seeing the tantrum at the moment because bond yields are rising. What we're not seeing, and what makes this different from last time, I think, is we're not seeing the taper, because actually Jay Powell, the Fed chairman now, is saying the reverse. He is saying that we are going to continue to stimulate the economy. He's making no indication that we're going to taper it back. But nonetheless, the bond market doesn't quite believe it. The bond market is seeing inflation coming back. It's seeing growth. It's seeing the wall of money that's being thrown at the pandemic. And it's saying that is going to lead to inflation. That's going to lead to higher bond yields.
One of the other things that's different this time around is where the rest of the world is. And the taper tantrum affects the rest of the world, of course. The US dollar affects the rest of the world. There are lots of pieces that are very much affected to it. But the rest of the world is in quite a different stage in their economies and often in their capital markets as well. Can we sort of delve into where we are globally that's different?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting areas to look at with regard to this, you know, so-called taper tantrum is emerging markets, because emerging markets were hit very badly in 2013. Again, it was to do with, you know, rising bond yields, a rising dollar, which affects disproportionately countries which have borrowed heavily in the US currency. So that was what was happening 8 years ago. I think if we look at what's happening today, those markets are much less vulnerable to a rise in US bond yields than they were then. We talked back then about the fragile five countries. These are countries with inflation problems, with current account deficit problems and with weaker currencies. I think that those countries are now in a stronger position than they were 8 years ago. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out in emerging markets. But certainly the initial evidence over the last few weeks, we've seen really quite a sharp pullback. MSCI Emerging Markets Index, I think, down about 7% just in a week or so. So, pretty big impact.
What do you think investors need to know about what has changed? So you mentioned a couple of things there, but I mean, for instance, emerging markets in terms of GDP on a global basis make up far more than they did even 8 years ago. Their equities that are investable globally also are on offer in a way that they certainly weren't X years ago. There are different options right now, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, emerging markets are clearly a much more important part of the global economy, and they're a more important part of global stock markets as well. And I think what's interesting about emerging markets is that they've traditionally been very different from developed markets. They've moved in slightly different ways. And I think that correlation has increased. I think that emerging markets look and feel a lot more like developed markets now. So, there is still a benefit in diversifying away from developed markets into emerging markets, but it's less obvious that there is that benefit than there was, say, 10, 20 years ago.
Do all of the titles that we use still fit? Sometimes they'll say that Canada, to an extent, the UK, more commodities focused, therefore more cyclical, therefore sometimes the bridge of more value oriented versus, I mean, are these names that we have for markets really in the midst of sort of changing? China is a huge innovator. How do you see that changing, if it matters even? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think they are. I think they are changing. I think that, maybe the distinction emerging markets, developed markets is just not so important anymore. Is China really an emerging market, or has it already emerged? I think, the more interesting distinction at the moment is you mentioned it there. There's this growth and value distinction, this rotation. I do think that we are in the middle of quite an interesting transition from growth to value. It's related to the bond yields that we've been talked about, but it feels slightly more than that. It feels like a more secular shift, and we quite often get that in a long bull market. So, we're 11 years into a bull market. That seems like a long way, but you go back to the 80s and 90s, even further back, you go back to the 50s and 60s, we had 19, 20-year bull markets. But halfway through those bull markets, we got a big transition from growth to value, and it feels like we may be at that kind of watershed this time around as well, which has big implications for asset allocation, the kinds of countries that people want to invest in, the kind of sectors that they want to invest in. And it feels like we're at a point of change.
Let's go a little bit to the UK. We've been getting GDP numbers sort of across the boards, across the world right now. What have you noticed about the status of Brexit, politics in the UK in response to the vaccine? Where should we begin? Because there's a political story, and then there's also sort of the numbers of what's happening with the Brexit story. Where do we begin there?
Yeah, a lot going on actually in the UK at the moment. So just today we had some quite interesting data. We had GDP data for January. It showed a fall, a 2.9% fall. That was actually rather less than the 4.9%, which had been predicted by economists. So I think it's an indication that, we are learning to live in this new pandemic / post-pandemic environment. So that was good news. There was some less good news in those figures, though. The export data between the UK and the EU was very poor. Something like a 40% decline in UK exports to the EU and a 30% decline the other way round. So that's a very sharp decline. Now, there's an element of sort of teething issues there. Some of the trade would have been pulled forward to December ahead of Brexit. But nonetheless, it does suggest that Brexit is starting to have a very significant impact, not just on sentiment, but actually on the hard numbers as well.
We see the you know, we'll see the sort of the visuals of lineups of trucks at borders and where things go. Things used to go from Ireland across the UK and so on. But it's actually sort of coming through in the numbers now. There are also some numbers I think you pointed to about certain business shifting, particularly to Amsterdam, actually.
Yeah, so I mean that's share dealing business. So you know the City of London obviously is a key part of the UK economy. Financial services is a very major contributor to the UK economy. There's nothing in this Brexit agreement about financial services, and so what we've seen is that Amsterdam actually overtook in January overtook the City of London for certain types of share dealing. So I think that was quite unexpected. I think people thought that, you know, maybe there'd be an increase in business in Frankfurt and Paris, but people were not really talking about Amsterdam. So I think that's another indication that Brexit is starting to have a real impact and not necessarily a positive impact.
The Chancellor of the Exchequer, we in Canada would probably call him the Finance Minister, Sunak, is it part of a Conservative government and apparently has a Conservative outlook. What has he done recently that has surprised you? But I don't know. I mean, how do you take it all in? There's a couple of different moves going on here at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had our annual budget last week, and you rightly point out that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Finance Minister, is a Conservative, and he is an orthodox, old-fashioned, if you like, conservative when it comes to fiscal prudence. He believes that he has done the right thing by spending very heavily during the pandemic, but he believes that over time he needs to restore the credibility of the government in terms of fiscal policy. So in the budget, he announced a most unexpected increase in the corporation tax rate from 19% to 25%. So the UK had pretty much the cheapest lowest corporation tax rate of all the G7 countries. It's now moving really up to the top of the range. Now, it is postponed for another 2 years. So there is an element of, you know, St. Augustine, you know, let me be chaste, but not just yet about this. But, you know, clearly the approach in the UK is very different, contrast with the approach, say, in the United States, where, of course, we've had that $1.9 trillion fiscal stimulus passed through Congress over the weekend. Rishi Sunak is taking a different approach, and you know, time will tell which is the right approach, and indeed whether he can even push that through if the state of the economy will allow him to do that. We shall see.
It's interesting. It's a political experiment. There are a lot of things that are experiments right now. Everyone's sort of trying to do their best. One of the questions rolling in right now is a discussion on containing the COVID situation. To what extent is the UK now, which certainly seems to be doing a much better job than for instance, the vaccine rollout in the EU right now. Can you sort of bring us up to date on where things are and some projections short term of emerging from the lockdowns?
You know, clearly the UK has made a lot of mistakes during the whole pandemic situation. I don't think anyone would claim that we made a good job of it in the early stages in terms of not closing down quickly enough. But the rollout of the vaccinations has been much more effective than it has been in Europe. And in fact, I think in terms of percentage of the population, we're ahead even of the United States on this. So we do seem to have got that right. That is allowing us to look forward to a reopening program between now and the end of June. And I think that's a positive. It, of course, also, relating back to our earlier conversation about bond yields, it's actually driving a very similar process in the UK. We've seen government bond yields rising by about 50% over the last month or so. Okay, they're still low. They're still less than 1%, the 10-year government bond yield. But still, that's a very significant rise.
So it also brings us back to the discussion of trade and governments and countries that have been able to sort of accelerate the reopening process are seen to be able to engage in trade perhaps more quickly, or it's a bit of a question mark, really. With Brexit, with perhaps an accelerated vaccine rollout, where does the trade horizon lead? I mean, we've heard Boris Johnson talk a bit more about keeping an open mind and doing different trade deals with China, with other places. Britain is a trading nation, as is Canada. Where are they looking to for increased trade in other places as the European discussion has its own bumps?
Yeah, well, I think, to be honest, I think the UK will trade wherever it can trade. And, you know, it's opening lines of negotiation and discussion all over the world. And of course, it has to, because, you know, Europe, the European Union, is Britain's biggest trading partner. So looking at those import-export figures, you know, that's a big gap that needs to be filled. And hopefully not all of that will need to be filled, because once we've got our heads around the red tape and the bureaucracy around the ins and outs of trade between us and the rest of the EU, then that gap will presumably narrow. But yes, you're absolutely right. China, the US, Canada, Australia, all of these places, you know, we are open for business with those places.
And, you know, sort of the all important, what does it mean for UK equities? And where does this sort of position things? In some cases, it's been rough. And so perhaps there's lots of opportunity to kind of come out the other side. Where would you put UK equities in amongst, you know, its competitors around the world?
Well, I think they're very attractive, actually, despite, you know, the negatives that I've mentioned. You know, a lot of that has been priced in. You know, the UK market has underperformed other comparable markets for 5 years or so now, really since the first announcement of the referendum in 2015. UK shares have underperformed sharply. However, since November, in particular, when we started to get the good news about the vaccines, the UK market has outperformed quite significantly. So it's not just about the UK and the UK being out of favour. It's also to do with the composition of the UK market. We talked a bit before about this growth to value rotation. The UK would be a beneficiary of that. You know, we're not big on technology. We don't have a load of tech stocks within our index. We do have a lot of energy stocks. We do have a lot of banks. We have a lot of the kinds of sectors which will do well in a growth to value rotation.
Right. And how sustainable is that? This is sort of the big question, isn't it? Everyone's wondering to what extent we've seen that rotation, and is there more to go? I guess, look, if you don't mind, for a sort of a short term, medium term, how do you see that playing out for now?
Yes. Well, I mean, clearly, you know, there has been a short term outperformance by value and by the related areas. Smaller companies, for example, have outperformed recently. But if you look at it on a slightly longer term view, so I printed myself off a chart of the 10-year performance of a global growth index and a global value index. And the outperformance by growth over the last 10 years has been pretty spectacular. There is a lot of catching up still to do. So I think that is a positive for a value-focused market like the UK.
Very interesting. Okay, yeah, a couple of questions. More sort of nuance between where you see... Are there aspects of Europe, for instance, in healthcare that have... Where has there been a beating taken because of some of the vaccine rollouts across Europe? I mean, there's always a bit of ambiguity there on how a country reopens and therefore the businesses within it. Are there opportunities there also, because presumably they'll figure this out at some point, the vaccine rollout?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I think the biggest opportunities in Europe actually lie in this reopening story. So tourism is absolutely of crucial importance to many European countries, particularly the southern European countries, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Greece. They are desperate to welcome tourists back. And that's why they're so delighted that the vaccination program in the UK has got underway to the extent it has. You know, they're all saying, you've been vaccinated, come and have your holidays in our countries. That will make a huge difference to Europe. I think the fact that the Asian and emerging markets have come out of this pandemic earlier. They went in first, they've come out first, is also a benefit to Europe in terms of the luxury goods exporters, for example. There are lots of areas in which Europe is a big and successful exporter to those Asian markets. And so that growing demand from those regions is a positive for Europe as well.
Let's go back a little bit to sort of EM and what it's seen lately, because there has been an unwind, and you know, people argue that's the US dollar, and then also just showing strength that the US economy is pulling ahead. There are others who will say it's a snapback trade, and then the world sort of goes back to growing in other parts of the world, and you know, developed markets have to work off the stimulus effect on some level. Is that sort of how you see things, that there is obviously a period of snapback recovery, whatever you want to call it, but ultimately growth happens in different demographics in countries around the world?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you can look at emerging markets in two ways. There is this short-term story, which is related to the bond yields, it's related to currencies, and it's probably not worth, you know, focusing on that too much, because there are always ups and downs with that regard. If you look at the long-term secular growth story of those markets, then it remains very strong, and the growth outlook for China and other Asian emerging markets remains significantly ahead of what we can expect from developed markets in the West. And I think compound up that difference over a period of 10, 20 years, and it makes a very strong case for continuing to invest in those markets.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And many of the companies come to market, for instance, in the UK market. So their headquarters, but therefore international businesses sort of take in those EM countries in a lot of cases.
That's a very good point to make, because actually, you know, investing in the emerging market growth story is not necessarily about investing in emerging stock markets. I mean, right. Interestingly, you know, if you look at the last 30 years, China has delivered massively higher GDP economic growth than other countries in the West. But look at its stock market, and actually, it has actually outperformed over 30 years by just 0.1% a year. So it's basically tracked developed markets. So that's very interesting. It just goes to show that stock markets and economies are different things. And to invest in, to benefit from the growth in an emerging market, you don't have to do it through emerging markets. You can do it through markets like the UK, commodity markets like Canada, like Australia, you know, other markets like the US. There are other ways of doing it.
Right. Brilliant to speak with you, Tom Stevens. And always, thanks for joining us. We'll see you again soon.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.